Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talk to Mike Marcolongo, who is near the end of a long and winding road to develop his family's farm property in the south end of the city the way they've always envisioned it. The detailed Claire Maltby secondary plan was going to be one of the biggest issues before City Council this year, and it still might be. And in the almost literal center of the debate, and the property for that matter, is the Marcolongo Farm. With council returning to some kind of regular order in the next couple of weeks, look for the planning of Claire Maltby to pick up again, and there is almost no one that has as much invested in that plan, both personally and professionally, than Mike Marcolongo. The fate of the farm is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. So to recap, we last left off with a Committee of the Whole decision on the open spaces strategy for Claire Maltby. This part of the plan laid out the rough placement of trails, the moraine ribbon, a number of neighborhood parks, and one big 10-hectare community park. Now, parkland has been, for the last couple of years, a kind of trigger for Guelph progressives, and if this was going to be done, it had to be done right. It was not. There were some delegations from the public that suggested skullduggery on the part of local developers to manipulate the public feedback process for the open sources strategy, but the real concern was, once again, that the best-laid plans of the Marcolongo family were being stepped on. To understand why this is such a sore spot, you have to go back over 40 years when Mike Marcolongo's father bought the 106-acre property. It was part of Puslinch at the time, but the senior Marcolongo had a vision to turn a portion of the property, including the over 100-year-old farmhouse and barn, into a medical training facility, as well as giving several acres of the property back to the city as new protected open space. Executing that vision has fallen on the shoulders of Mike Marcolongo and his mother, and it has been refined to include a plan from Options for Homes, a nonprofit that offers financial tools to help people buy a home. The plan for the Marcolongo farm is bold, it's ambitious, and it's seen roadblocks at almost every turn. The latest one was when the city's open spaces plan took 35 acres meant for that housing and allocated it to the community park instead. Now, the committee eventually overrode that decision, but does that mean smooth sailing for the Marcolongos from this point on? That's one of the many questions that Mike Marcolongo will answer on this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast, which has long been delayed as we've been covering matters related to the pandemic. Marcolongo will talk about his family's long history with the property, his charity, and how he started working with Options for Homes. He also talks about the process, the struggles dealing with other developers and the city staff, and whether he's felt besieged through the process. We discuss whether he's been surprised at how political this whole thing has become and whether he thinks all that politicking might now be over, and we get his advice for the next person with a bold plan for a big piece of land in Guelph. And finally, Marcolongo will also talk about his memories and the lessons he's taking with him from the last 40-some-odd years. So I caught up with Mike Marcolongo way back at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic by phone from his home in Guelph. So, Mike Marcolongo, thank you for joining me by social distance today.
Pleasure.
Let's start at the beginning. This property, the Marcolongo Farm, although that's what we're calling it, it has not been, for time in memoriam, the Marcolongo Farm. This is an investment that your parents made. Talk about that a bit in terms of like how they ended up buying the property and how these grand plans that they envisioned got started.
Sure. I'm happy to speak to that. So it is an investment, a social investment, I think I would call it, in terms of what's happened in the last 50 years. So my parents bought the farm in 1972. They were driving down Gordon Street into Guelph, and there was a for sale sign, and at the time bought it. They also, at the same time, they started a not-for-profit to help travelers when you go overseas, so providing travelers with essentially medical advice. At the time, there was no internet, and in order to get any medical recommendations or advice, it's quite difficult to find that information. So they were helping travel agents and people who were overseas getting sick in terms of finding them physicians who were Western trained in the developing world. And from that kind of viewpoint, in that perspective, they were bought this land, 105 acres, to basically start a training center for developing world physicians so they could get trained here, get the knowledge they require for travel medicine, and then take that back to their respective countries. So after they bought the land in around 1974, they donated to their own foundation. So growing up at the farm, it was always understood that, you know, we lived here and my parents rented the farmhouse, but it was never something that that we owned, as the Marco Ongos. There was also this idea that it belonged to the foundation and that it was here to help others.
Right. It's interesting to think, and maybe you can speak to this a bit, but when we're talking about 1974, that's 45 years ago, over 45 years ago, and you're finally coming to the end of sort of this process where the vision of the land is realized. Your parents, when they closed the deal in 1974, how long did they think it would take sort of it get going to actually bring the land to the fruition according to, you know, what they were planning?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think over time, what's happened, there's been a bit of a shift. So, one, the city has grown exponentially or significantly, and it's moved south. Who would have predicted that this, you know, a rural area, at the time it was supposed to be a township, would have become absorbed by the city of Guelph? But I think the other key shift was my father passed away when I was quite young, 12, in 1988. And also the thinking's changed in terms of you don't bring developing world physicians to Canada, give them training, expect them to go back. The shifting's really changed where the training is brought to them overseas. And so the focus of the foundation has also shifted. We've moved towards scholarships, and the training center idea is no longer seen as a viable concern for various reasons.
Right.
And so we've really ramped up the scholarship. So the idea was, how do we leverage the land to create an endowment for really ramping up scholarships for developing world physicians? So there's two trends here. One is the urbanization of the city, maybe seen as an opportunity, but also the thinking shifted towards better supporting developing world physicians.
Mm-hmm.
We've, over the years, just to give you some background, we've been entrepreneurial about how do we leverage the assets on the land. We really didn't want to develop the land. Like, we obviously become attached. You live here, you see the landscape, you understand the ecological importance of the land. And so even back in 2011, we had proposed the largest community finance solar facility in Ontario. We were options for green energy. And it was, we had put an application for a 7-megawatt solar facility that would have been community funded. And we never did get the feed-in tariff, so we abandoned those plans. But the idea was always, how do we do something creative, different, that also supports the community while we have this land as an asset?
Right. Correct me if I'm wrong, though, isn't part of the planned use, there's still going to be a component for the foundation on the property?
Yeah, so the foundation's going to hold on to the assets at the front of the property, the heritage asset.
Right.
The foundation's hoping to adapt to new uses and hoping to derive some income, some ongoing income from those assets. In terms of it, it is planned to be kind of a commercial institutional office zoning in the future.
All right, cool.
Back in 2014, I think you're probably gonna ask about, you know, the rest of the land.
So
it's a 5-acre property, and in 2014 we did the foundation was looking at how do we ramp up the scholarship, and so we looked at basically severing off 35 acres and partnering with a housing developer on that. So we did send ask for proposals from the development community in terms of those 35 acres, and we did get three offers for the land, and we did go with Options for Homes out of Toronto because you know we're closely enmeshed in terms of our value, but also it would provide a significant affordable entry level home ownership development on those 35 acres.
Right, and this is where I don't want to say things get dicey because there's really nothing dicey about Options for Homes, but I think maybe there was an mistaken impression that this development with Options for Homes was going to be affordable vis-a-vis below market to some degree. But Options for Homes sounds, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they sound like basically they have a financing model that makes it possible for people to buy market value homes, people who might not be otherwise be able to access home ownership because of financial hurdles like down payments and things like that.
Yeah, right. So let me speak to that. I think the context is really important here in terms of what is affordable today, and that terminology of affordability is used by so many people and it has so many different meanings that it's become confusing. I think in terms of the context, global capital currently is transforming our local housing market. So what we're seeing is the erosion of affordability in general for anybody, whether you're middle income or even high income. So local salaries have become detached from our housing market. So it's a significant structural issue that we're facing at this point in time. Options for homes, it's not the panacea kind of solution in terms of resolving that issue. They do have, it takes a bunch of measures to make entry-level home ownership easier to get to, and I'll speak to those quickly. I don't represent Options for Homes, so I don't want to speak on their behalf, but I'll just say that a couple things they do is, as you alluded to, the first thing is you can have a second mortgage on the property. So instead of having to raise, you know, the 20% for the down payment, they will lend you, 10 or 15% so that you're able to get into the market and buy your unit. That's one approach. They build, when you buy an Options for Homes unit, you won't find granite countertops and gold taps and all those high-end finishes. You also won't find those, high-end amenity spaces with gyms and pools and so on. And that's their way of trying to keep costs down. So it lowers the barriers to entry as well. I think the last thing that they do, which is I don't hear a lot of people speaking to, but I think it's an important one in terms of homes and housing now seen as just another investment opportunity, or it's just seen as not a necessity, but as a place to invest. One of the ways they challenge that is you can't purchase an Options for Home property if you're going to rent it out. So they have an affidavit that you need to sign that you're not renting it out, but it's for your own use. And so that also works to dampen some speculation around housing in our community.
That's interesting too, because so much of what's going on is, I think anyone who's trying to develop any kind of affordable housing, no matter your definition, will tell you is that, you know, we have a very market-driven product in terms of housing, and unless the government, I make this joke, but unless the government finds $500 million in the couch cushions, it's going to be very hard to get public housing going. So we have to very much lean on private developers to help fill the stock. And you know, it sounds like Options for Homes is at least trying something innovative, other than the same old model of going to your bank, getting a mortgage, and you know, investing that way.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and you raise the role of government. I mean, unless the government plays a bigger role, both in terms of incentivizing larger supply of housing and or providing other incentives for trying to regulate and trying to regulate basically speculation,
right.
The way it's done it with the foreigner's tax, there's not a lot of tools that not-for-profits have to try and challenge the current marketplace.
I want to talk about your experience in trying to move forward with your plan, because people who've are aware of your story maybe saw it in the news, probably recognize your face, looking sternly at the camera about all the latest developments. I don't want to really go over it beat by beat, but, you were raised with this idea that this is very much a gift that your family was giving to the city. And it seems like whether it's the city of Guelph, whether it's other area developers, you've had a lot of hurdles to jump over. Have you felt besieged during this process? And I mean, on top of it all, this was your parents' dream, and you kind of inherited the need to carry it over the end zone. So, how has sort of your perceptions of, trying to accomplish this task sort of changed over time?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think the key kind of conversation piece, and it has taken a lot of tenacity, a lot of sacrifice in terms of, like, I put my career on hold because I'm focusing so much energy on this issue. My partner has been very patient, my family's been very patient with me, because it is all consuming, and we've had a few couple surprises come out of nowhere, and we can speak about those in a few minutes. And I've had to remind people that there's no financial return here, and we're not doing it for profit. Just at the recent committee of the whole meeting, I used an analogy to try to explain it and remind counselors that there's no financial benefit here for myself and my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the analogy of, we all know the stereotype of the father who's kind of holding his son next to him and saying, "Son," he's looking out towards the property and saying, "Son, this is going to be all yours one day." And I had to explain that in my case, my father was like, "Son, none of this will be yours one day." And that's hard for people to understand in terms of what's motivating you. Why are you so tenacious about it? We live in cynical times, but we believe, and I believe, that there still is such a thing as altruism. And the fact that there's this land here that can be leveraged for community good is unprecedented. And we're gonna ensure that it goes towards community good and towards helping people in the developing world. When Jean Vanier it was exposed that he's a sexual predator, right? It's very hard to be cynical. It's hard to believe in something, but our motivation isn't driven by dollar values, and we're going to make sure that we're going to maximize the social investment that it is.
At the same time, though, you have seen the opposite too, and there's been tremendous community support for the vision of your mother and your father in terms of using that property for a public good.
Yeah, that's right. No, and you know what? That's been it's been amazing. We have been we've been blessed. This community has rallied around us in ways that we could not have imagined, we feel privileged to be part of this community, that people are who care and they're concerned. And we've had farm walks, we've had different meetings, and people have been coming out over and over and untiringly so. I'm tired of this issue, and I get down that time, but people are just so generous with their time, with their energy, with spreading the message that of what we're trying to do and sharing our vision for the property, which has been amazing. There've been, you know, I've, you also need a thick skin in this business or in this circle. I did get an email from someone saying you were just building a social housing ghetto, and it's a bad idea. There've been a lot of detractors, even from within the activist circle. That's okay. I mean, it's important to be skeptical and to challenge this vision and to make sure that it does reflect what our community wants and needs. We're just kind of stewards of the land, and we think we know what could happen or the best scenario could be for this community, but it will evolve over time.
Right.
And it will evolve to reflect our community's priorities.
I mean, that's almost a byproduct of process too, because in thinking about what you're doing, you're fronting this property. It's literally got your name on it. You have been very, very open about intentions and plans and what you're working towards, which is, and I've been to enough planning meetings to know that's not always necessarily the case. And sometimes you get people utterly surprised about what kind of development is going up on an area in their neighborhood or in another part of town. I wonder if maybe just from your experience, if maybe your openness has sort of worked against you in this process.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's interesting because transparency, you could argue, some people would argue, brings about liabilities. But transparency in our case, I think we've just built more and more trust around what we're trying to do here. We have been clear from the beginning. I mean, transparency started back in 2007 when we approached Heritage Guelph and said, we think there's some significant heritage assets on this property, and we'd like to move forward with designating the city's and one of Ontario's largest cultural heritage landscapes. So we've been always transparent about our motivations, and ultimately it pays off. The challenge is you're seen as the outlier or as the do-gooder. So you, I would suggest you also get dumped on by some of the players around you, or just speculating for their bottom line.
Right.
So it's like, oh, the Mark Longos don't care about making a lot of money here, so why don't we just dump, the community park on their property? And there's been, councillors that have suggested that, or councillors on behalf of developers suggested that. There's been consultants and home builders who have suggested that as well. So it's not easy being the outlier, especially if you're being transparent, because there's a lot of focus on what you're doing in your property, whereas I would suggest there's very little kind of focus on what's happening on the remaining 900 acres in Claremalpi.
And I mean, that in a way could sound paranoid, and I mean, who can blame you? But there have been significant, adversarial actions towards, as you said, you went through this process to get that property recognized as natural heritage, and there were some developers who stood in the way of that.
Yeah, that's right. So you're referring to the cultural heritage landscape designation. So in 2011, council did move forward with approving that the designation moved forward. It was never posted as an intention to designate. And so when we heard, and we were like, well, this is going to be just feather in the city's cap in terms of the largest designation in the city, the first major cultural heritage landscape, we didn't think there would be any issues. But back in the fall of December of 2017, we were informed that there could possibly be an arterial or crosser road through the cultural heritage landscape, and we were quite surprised. So we asked the city to move forward with the designation, and we weren't being heard. There was a lack of response from City Hall from city staff about it, and so that became a bit of a fight with City Hall to try and get that designation to go forward. Eventually, when it was posted to the notice of intention to designate, it was posted and it was going forward. We had neighboring developers, so Thomas Field Homes to the south, and the number company Thomasville Homes to the north, which is the Springfield Golf Course, and the Number Company to the south, essentially challenged the designation. We had to spend quite a bit of money with consultants and lawyers to defend the designation as it was heading towards a Conservation Review Board hearing. So the Conservation Review Board is essentially a provincial tribunal for heritage-related matters. Now, at the last minute, they pulled out. So it was just, another challenge as you're trying to do the right thing here in Claremont.
I'm wondering, too, has it all been worth it?
We're not there yet. So
even just so far, I mean, again, it strikes me that, again, you're carrying not your vision, but the family vision. You've become the steward of that, and even just to get it this far has been, sacrifice, advocacy, learning about planning law, learning about planning process. At what point do you? I guess at what point can you imagine that the spirit breaks and just I have all this land here, even if I were to keep 1% of the profits, I'd probably be doing pretty well. It just, at what point does altruism fail, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah. Has it been worth it? I'll tell you what, it has been, just because of the community response to what we're trying to do here. And that's what makes it worth it. We're humbled by total strangers basically reaching out to us and supporting our vision and reaching out to council and saying, you can't let this happen, or you need to let this affordable housing project happen. You don't abandon your vision when the community is rallying behind you. That's for sure. The other reality is, with every kind of battle that we fought, we've been winning them. So it's been actually quite. You can only be optimistic with in terms of what's happening. We believe in the social capital in this community, and that's what's going to win the day.
Well, as you said, it's far from over. But coming out of Committee of the Whole, I think, at least for me as a observer of council, it seemed maybe the process of getting the community park off of your land so that you can move forward with your vision seemed a bit easier than I had anticipated. So how are you feeeling now as, that you've cleared that hurdle and maybe, I don't want to say this is the last challenge, I don't want to jinx you, but... how are you feeling at this point in the process?
Yeah, so I think it's important to contextualize for your listeners that the community park was slated on the property, on a Number Company property that be developed by Fusion Home, just south of us. Essentially, it was slated there from this November or December of 2017. Mm. And so... quite late in the process, and some would say at the 11th hour in the process, in June of last year, and that decision to move it has certainly delayed the process. So in June of 2019, and you're already basically 4 years into the process, the community park mysteriously shifted over to be predominantly on the Marco Longo farm, and it would jeopardize the Options for Homes project as well as the last remaining 7 acres open space that we've committed to go to social housing. The last year, almost the last year, has been a big fight in terms of reminding city staff of, transparency in the process and of doing proper engagement. You can't just set up these community consultations mm-hmm. and not differentiate between members of the community who have a pecuniary interest. So there's developers and there are consultants in the room who understand lot lines, who understand what the financial implications are for their properties if the community park gets moved to their property. And then also include you know, the average resident in the South End or in the city of Guelph who has no idea what the what they're looking at in terms of some rather obtuse maps.
Right.
So how do I feel? We feel great at this point. The community as a whole did suggest that you moved to the best location, which is Springfield Golf Course. I mean, that's the only property with direct sight lines to Hawk Pond. Not sure if you're a golfer, Adam, but it is a stunning viewscape from the golf course onto Hawk Pond. And that wetland was actually, that part of Hawk Pond was significantly modified in late 80s by Thomas Field Homes when they built the golf course. To this day, that golf course only has a permit for a 9-hole golf course. And it is an 18-hole golf course. So they did do a lot of dredging and filling of Hawk Pond, which is, I might add, it is Guelph's second largest wetland complex. So it is a significant natural feature. And we're hoping that, you know, there's some openness with the city to also include the cultural heritage landscape, which we've offered to bequeath to the city for parkland. And it will be connected to that, to essentially the best parkland location on Springfield Golf Course. So it could be a phenomenal legacy park, which embraces a lot of the natural heritage system, significantly more than just either option one, which is on Springfield Golf Course, or option two, which was on the Marcolongo Farm. Springfield Golf Course as probably the best location and in terms of sight lines to Hawk Pond and connection to water and in terms of placemaking. But I do hope that the City of Guelph does take advantage of our offer to bequeath those 6 acres of the culture and landscape, which would be connected to Springfield Golf Course, especially given the uncertainty of the financial considerations around acquiring parkland in terms of the new essentially community charge benefit. So the new approach that the provincial government is suggesting as part of parkland acquisition through the Planning Act.
Right, and that's another big question mark going forward. I mean, the way the things have gone so far and the financial situation being what it is, people see that you are acting in an altruistic way and may come back to you and say, well, you already have these plans to bequeath a certain amount of land. We're all out here trying to make a profit, so why are you cutting into our profits? Well, you know, why don't we just, you know, take your land, give you, you know, the market value for it, and we will proceed with the community park regardless of what other plans you might have.
Right, and I think that's an important consideration that you're pointing to, which is we're not developers in a traditional sense. And so I think a lot of the big housing players, and there's big housing players in Claremont Beach, so there's Mattamy Homes across the street, Thomas Field Homes, Carson Reed Homes, and so on. So they're all big players. The challenge for them in terms of community park, which is 10 hectares of 24 acres, it's not the fact that they won't be reimbursed for the assessed land value of you know, the community park.
Right.
To them, a significant cost is the opportunity cost of not building their homes on those properties. So we're talking tens of millions of dollars, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, people are saying, well, you know, your message about affordable housing and jeopardizing affordable housing, if we put the community park on the Marcolongo Farm, oh, that's just a false narrative, right? And so our response back is, no, it's not a false narrative. We're the only ones that have basically asked the city to go to a medium density zoning on the property, beyond the Gordon Street corridor, and we're, you know, our intentions, we want to move forward with this affordable housing project. This is what the city needs. Most of the other players in the city, they've agreed to this high density corridor, what some people are calling the Gordon Street Canyon, so up to 18 stories of essentially condos right along Gordon Street, and we're seeing the beginning of that stub with the Tricard development at Clare and Gordon. So that's going to continue. But beyond that, it's they're planning essentially low density behind that very high density.
Yeah.
And so, you know, from a planning perspective, I think I want to emphasize here that we're different, not only in terms of the, we're suggesting gentle zoning, so up to four stories, maybe along in the entire property, where you have kind of that, you know, livable, human scale, walkable community. Whereas I think everyone else is just thinking, oh, we're just going to build as per usual, another automobile dependent, automobile oriented development. So we'll have that high density along Gordon Street, and everyone else will have that low density behind there that, again, doesn't create those walkable human scale communities. So I think that's one of the challenges that we have. Back in May of 2019, the densities actually were lowered. The density requirements were lowered for Claremont-B based on the changes to the Ontario Growth Plan. So provincially, the province mandated that you no longer need to move towards 80 persons and jobs per hectare, and it's back to 60 person jobs per hectare. So we're going to be failing in terms of providing that transit supportive planning that results in the land being paved over.
Right.
And that's the challenges we have, right? We need to, I was really inspired by Jennifer Kiesmack coming to Guelph recently, and she spoke about that human scale, walkable community. Claremont-B is not going to be that unless we start shifting gears here.
Right. And it's also a reminder, too, that we're not just talking about a singular city vision and then turning that over to developers to enact it, that every developer, every landowner, including yourself, has a very different vision of what's going to go on in Claremont-B, and that part, this process is really meant to be us trying to figure out how to compromise on all those visions to come up with a singular vision. And so far, in after years of consultations, that still seems to be up in the air.
That's right. Yeah. Another point I'd like to make is, you know, at Forum 2041 with Jennifer Kiesmatt, you know, we had Todd Salter, the head of planning, speaking to the intensification of Guelph, and kudos to our, you know, our city staff for really working towards intensification. But I do think the one aspect that was really not highlighted there is the marketplace.
Mm.
The fact that land is becoming so expensive has also pushed the development industry towards intensifying. And I'd say even as much as the planning policies that have been put into place by either the provincial government or our municipality, the reality is we need to use land better and use it more sensibly. And that's how we're going to get better, you know, better density. But how do we make community with that increasing density?
Yeah.
And I think this also relates to the vision for a stellar community park in Claremont-B. And, you know, to paraphrase Jennifer Kiesmatt, if you just add density but don't create great public spaces, you create problems. Access to nature is critical to human well-being. And I totally agree with her. We need to basically make some sound decisions at this point in time for the 16 to 25,000 residents that will be living in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough when it's just a speculative environment at this point in time, and there's no residents that can speak up. And so we've been doing our best to try and engage the rest of the city and say, this is what's at stake. Get engaged today, because those decisions will have multi-generational impacts down the road.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to just the sheer unprecedentedness of developing a plan like this, and the opportunity to develop an area like this, which maybe to wind down, you know, this is, we've talked a lot about how this is a unique property and a unique circumstance for you, but we want people to be good citizens. We want the landowners to be good citizens and think about giving back to the community in significant or even just, you know, moderate ways. What advice do you have to give people who may be thinking along your lines like you who want to give back have property that they can activate in a socially good way. And looking at your situation and looking at the battles you've had to fight, you know, what's your advice to them in terms of how best to navigate this process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my advice is don't do it alone. You know, work with community players, community actors, work with civil society to make sure that your plans and your vision reflects their priorities, but also that they can help you carry you through the difficult times.
Mm. And maybe we'll end on a kind of personal question, but you know, when the time comes to say goodbye to the farmhouse and the farmland, you know, not forever, because part of it will still be accessible to the public, but you know, for your own personal experience, because again, this has been your life, you know, when it comes time to say goodbye to the Markalongo farm, you know, what do you take with you in terms of memories?
Mm-hmm. I look forward to the day where, you know, we've set the foundation and the framework for our community to take advantage of that, so that what happens here benefits the most people and certainly some of the most vulnerable people in our society, so that, you know, that social capital and essentially community wealth increases over time, and that's a beautiful thing to leave behind. You know, I think as a family we're also a bit kind of post-material in terms of you know, what we want to take away in terms of actual material things. A couple years ago we took a year off work and we just traveled the world with our kids. We visited 14 countries, and it's also kind of changed our view in terms of what's important and what we actually need. So we have a small house downtown. It's I think 1100 square feet, and at the time we were like, well, you know, we've got two growing kids now, they're now teenagers. We were thinking, you know, 1,100 square feet, it's kind of small. And then we traveled the world and we came back and we're like, wow, this is a big house compared to how the rest of the world lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
What we're going to take away from the farm is going to be immaterial. And you know, for better or worse, yes, it's been a difficult fight in terms of trying to get City Hall to understand our a vision for the property and respect it and see value in it. But at the end of the day, the relationships that we foster with community members and that kind of social capital has been enormous, and it's been, those relationships have been phenomenal. So, if we're left with only those relationships, then that's enough for us.
So, Mike Markalongo, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for all your hard work. I hope we deliver those. I hope we're able to deliver on everything you've just laid out there. And thanks for talking to me today.
Thanks, Adam. It's been a pleasure. And you know, we will keep the fight up, and we're pretty confident that we'll get a pretty amazing outcome in terms of the property and in terms of benefits to this community. I do also want to thank you in terms of all the work you do in terms of the public service. As you know, the media is a shifting landscape at this point, and you provide a tremendous service to our community, both in terms of, you know, tweeting council meetings, your podcast, and the articles you write. If it wasn't for people like yourself, it would be much harder to galvanize community in terms of important issues in this city.
Well, I always appreciate hearing that. I don't take praise very well, but I will take it today. And once again, that was Mike Marcolongo. The approved plan for the open spaces strategy for the Claire Maltby secondary plan will be ratified by City Council at some point now that regular meetings of council are resuming, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, you can see all the Claire Maltby documents at the city's website under the Plans and Strategies heading. And that is it for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is usually recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast every Wednesday from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from the host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you'll get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits every Friday. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com, reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson, or at Guelph Politico. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you soon. And until then, see you next time.